So this was kind of exciting for me because I use Perry's book in my class, and I told some of my students that I was going to be on a panel with him, and the response I got was, well, don't say anything stupid. So unfortunately, that's the only thing I can't guarantee here. Anyway, so I don't know exactly what I'm doing with that title, but it's sort of, I can look at it a certain way and say I'm totally right, and a certain way and say I'm totally wrong, but I went with it to be provocative. So, okay, so just starting off, show you where I'm going with this. John Taylor, the Taylor Rule, we talked a lot about that this morning. In 2009, after the Fed started raising reserve balances, well, not 5 or 6 months after they started to raise reserve balances, put this out on the Financial Times, and unfortunately I can't see the whole slide up here, so you can see his quote there. There's no question that this enormous increase in reserve balances will lead to inflation unless it's reversed. And so this panel is about central bank deleveraging, and that's, I guess, essentially what I'm talking about. And so I wanted to start you with that quote. It's sort of the standard view of the Fed's printing money and it's going to be inflationary at some point, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm here to, I guess, sort of debunk that view a bit. Well, not a bit, debunk that view. Go that way. So just to show you where we're coming from, some items on the Fed's balance sheet over the last 5 years. This isn't everything, so the balance sheet isn't supposed to balance here. But if you look at reserve balances, I guess it reads from right to left. We're currently at a point of about $2.8 trillion. This is as of last week, $2.8 trillion in reserve balances. Whereas 2007, which was a bit before things started to go bad, we're at $15 billion. So, and that was $15, $25, $30 billion was fairly normal. Prior to 2007, the federal funds market ran essentially on that much, and now here we are at $2.8 trillion. So if you're going to get back to, say, normalcy, somewhere in the $15 to $30 billion range would be just normal. Okay, so a little bit of wonkiness, I guess, as Barry was saying, we're going to get into the weeds a little bit on this panel, perhaps. So a little bit of 101 on the federal funds market and the Fed's operations. So first off, if we look here, we've got the Fed's balance sheet, or sort of a representation of the Fed's balance sheet and the bank balance sheet. The thing to take note of there is that the Fed is the banker's bank, and so the bank's reserve balance is essentially the deposit account that it's holding with the Fed, and that is the liability on the Fed's balance sheet. So if we then start to look across banks, what we see is all of the banks, of course, have an account at the Fed and are holding reserve balances. And the point there is individually banks can borrow and lend and get rid of reserve balances, but in the system as a whole they can't because the entire system's level of reserve balances is on the Fed's balance sheet. And from basic double entry accounting, unless you change something on the Fed's balance sheet, you're not going to change the total quantity of reserve balances. So banks are borrowing and lending to and from each other, but it's basically just changing who owns the same quantity of reserve balances. Okay, so one of the main things going on in the federal funds market is banks are settling payments and borrowing and lending in order to be able to settle payments. And so this is data from Federal Reserve's website, and the far right column I put together, and I can't see it up here, but the far right column I put together, and it's basically I took the second to the right column and divided it by annual GDP. And what it is, it's the percent of GDP that is settled on a daily basis, on average, in the federal funds market. So what you see is 20% of annual GDP is settled using reserve accounts as banks just settling payments amongst themselves. So 20% on any given day, that's the average. And so you can see 15 to 20% is essentially where we are. So if you have that many payments being settled on a daily basis, and that 15 to 20% in many cases is netting a much larger amount of payments that are being settled on private payment systems. So if you have that many payments being settled, you really can't let that get disrupted. And that's really the Fed's first goal in the federal funds market, is to make sure that the payment system is accommodated. And so as banks need more payments or need more reserve balances to settle payments, the Fed accommodates that. To do otherwise would be to threaten the payment system. As we saw, though, they generally needed $15 to $20 billion, at least overnight, in order to do that. They do generally receive intraday overdrafts, and then at the end of the day, they are supposed to get rid of those intraday overdrafts, and that's how you end up with that $15 to $20 billion by the end of the day. Okay, so if we look at that, you're trying to settle $2 or $3 trillion of payments a day. That's not really sensitive to the interest rate. So what banks demand for reserve balances look like is essentially vertical, and this is what the federal funds market essentially kind of looked like before 2008. So there's a penalty rate that the Fed charges above its target rate, and the Fed just tries to accommodate the quantity that banks need at the target rate it's setting. Most of you, when you took your economics class, you learned about reserve requirements. Unfortunately, reserve requirements are just a very, very small part of the story, although that's essentially what we learn about when we take a macroeconomics course. Banks are allowed to meet reserve requirements over a two-week period. And it actually doesn't change anything. What it does is give banks more leeway in terms of their demand for reserve balance, so it sort of flattens out the curve. So a bank might need, instead of $20 billion on any given day, they need $20 billion over 2 weeks to average that much. And so that gives them more leeway. And so you have, during the period, you will have a flatter region there that actually essentially makes it easier for the Fed to hit the quantity that banks want to achieve its target. It has very little to do with controlling the money supply. Actually, it has nothing to do with controlling the money supply. By the end of the maintenance period, though, banks don't have any more days to meet the reserve requirement, so you end up with this this curve that's essentially vertical again. And so the Fed is, if it's not going to accommodate banks, it's going to accommodate them at the penalty rate. So the Fed is essentially setting a target, an interest rate target, whether it wants to or not. Okay, so summarizing, I guess, balance sheets. I can't see that on here. Federal Reserve balances exist only on the Fed's balance sheet, and the Fed has to protect the payment system intraday and overnight. And reserve requirements don't change that fact. And so the Fed is necessarily setting an interest rate target. And there's some nice research from the Fed that sort of says the same thing, so I'm just going to put this up here. New York Fed, Martin and McAndrews, cost of reserves essentially is a policy variable, as they said. And just a few weeks ago, Bernanke said the same thing. Contrary to what sometimes seems to be alleged, the Fed cannot somehow withdraw and leave interest rates to be determined by the markets. It has no choice but to set the short-term interest rate somewhere. So the Fed is supplying the balances that are being used to settle all these payments. It can't not set the terms on how banks can acquire those balances. Okay, if it decides not to, it's essentially setting the rate at its penalty rate if it provides too few, or it's setting it at zero if it provides too many. Okay, then we're going to go into banks and credit creation 101. So the traditional money multiplier that you guys are probably aware of is where the Fed, through its open market operations, increases reserve balances. That adds to the excess reserves of banks and enables banks to create more loans and create more deposits. So, unfortunately, it just actually doesn't work that way. In the real world, banks create loans which create deposits. And so you can see there, the loan itself creates the deposit. This is basic double entry accounting. It can't work any other way. If banks have required reserves that they have to meet, they obtain those in the money markets. Say the federal funds market. Remember, the Fed is accommodating in the federal funds market at its target rate. If banks see a deposit outflow, they make a loan. And usually when you borrow money, it's because you're going to spend it or make a payment. So the bank makes a loan, the borrower then withdraws, and so the deposit leaves the bank, and the bank has to settle the payment. If the bank doesn't have enough reserve balances to settle the payment, it goes into the money markets and borrows to cover that as well. Okay, so if a bank then is going to make loans, the loans are not constrained by the quantity of reserves. What constrains the quantity of reserve, sorry, what constrains the loans in this case is the fact that if you look at that balance sheet, the bank now ends up with 100 in loans on the asset side and 100 in borrowings, say from the money market on the liability side. Well, the borrowings earn less, or the bank has to pay more interest on those borrowings, and so this reduces the profitability of the loan. The bank's ability to create the loan isn't constrained. You know, you can have capital requirements, and the Fed can change the interest rate and those kind of things to affect how much banks are going to lend, but the quantity of reserves doesn't affect how much the banks are going to lend. Okay, so I have the interest rate with an arrow to borrowing there because that's showing that that's essentially the interest rate that the bank is going to pay. Okay, so banks are not reserve constrained, and the Fed accommodates the target rate. So what does that mean? Well, in 2009, a lot of people were saying this. It's just my blog post is one that I knew exactly where it was, so it was easier to find. Back in 2009, a few months after John Taylor said this would create inflation, I wrote a blog post. It's actually my first blog post, saying that this would not create inflation. Don't worry about it. And it's because basically banks have the same ability to create loans with $800 billion in reserve balances or $2.7 billion in reserve balances as they have when there's $15 or $20 billion. It's because loans create deposits and the Fed is setting a target rate. When you set an interest rate, that means you're accommodating that demand for reserve balances. And the Fed has to set an interest rate target. Okay, so does this mean monetarism is dead? Well, not so fast, say the mainstream economists. So here we go with something from the New York Fed, December 2009, it looks like. So they are essentially agreeing with me here in this part in the circle there. Quantity of reserves in the banking system reflects the scale of the Fed's policy initiatives, but conveys no information about the effects on bank lending or the economy more broadly. It's exactly what I've been saying. A number of people were wondering, well, why are banks holding all these excess reserves? Well, if you recall from the Fed's balance sheet, they're on the Fed's balance sheet, and so only some other change in the Fed's balance sheet can change that quantity. So if banks are borrowing and lending them to and from each other, that's just moving them around the banks. It's not changing the actual quantity. Okay, so as they say, this conclusion may seem strange at first glance because it's not what our money multiplier tells us happens. And then they make what I would say is their mistake. They say textbook accounts of the money multiplier assume banks do not earn interest on their reserves. The central bank pays interest on reserves at its target rate, and banks don't face an opportunity cost of holding reserves, and a money multiplier does not come into play. So this is something we've heard a bit, that the reason why all these reserves are not creating hyperinflation is because the Fed is paying 0.25% on the reserves. Right. So this is essentially what this is saying. It's saying that a bank would be indifferent from having the balance sheet on the left and the balance sheet on the right. Okay, the bank, remember, holds a little bit of reserve balances on the left is sort of the normal state. Bank is holding a little bit of reserves to sell payments, meet reserve requirements. Then they have some deposits, liabilities, and they're making loans. On the right-hand side, the bank is not making loans. It's just holding up a bunch of reserve balances because it's earning interest on them. So the idea that the banks aren't making loans because reserve balances are earning interest is saying the one on the right is just as good to a bank as the one on the left. Okay. We know that's not true. Profitability. How many banks out there would actually do this? They wouldn't. As Hyman Minsky told us, banks had to earn at least 4%, 4.5% over their liabilities, something like that. Well, basically, in this case, the borrowings are going to have the same rate as the interest on reserves, so it's not going to be enough to make profit there. Secondly, loans create deposits. If the bank wants to make a loan, they can just do it. Right? And the balance sheet would look like this. So there's no constraint there on the bank for making the loan. There's not really an opportunity cost. The bank just makes the loan. But thirdly, under normal circumstances, banks can essentially do the same thing that they're doing right now with interest on reserves because we have these things in the economy called T-bills, maybe you've heard of them. They earn about the same rate of interest as interest on reserves, and they're out there, and banks could, if they on their balance sheet if they didn't want to make any loans. And if you go look at bank balance sheets, they're not doing that under normal circumstances because, as we showed, it's not profitable. Okay? So we end up with two views that say, in the mainstream of economics, the New Keynesian model, whatever, that say, that explain to us why this increase in reserve balances isn't causing inflation. The first one is the one I just said, interest on reserves target equals the target rate stops QE in its tracks. Second one, return on money set equal to the return on T-bills is equal to zero. We're at the lower bounds. So base money, as the term goes, is equal to T-bills in terms of the return, so we're indifferent. So if you give us more base money, it's as if you gave us more bills, so we're not going to spend it. Okay. This is basically Krugman's definition of the liquidity trap when we're at the lower bound. It's not the same one that Paul was talking about, and it's certainly not the same one by any stretch that Keynes was talking about. And Krugman has told us many times he doesn't care. Anyway, then I also found this nice quote from Krugman where he basically says, well, if B doesn't hold, then A does too. Meaning, once the Fed starts raising interest rates, if they're paying interest on them, then you're going to have the same thing. Right? You're going to basically have A. So it's true that the Fed could sterilize the impact of a rise in the monetary base, meaning if the Fed starts to do QE, but if they raise the interest rate, it pays on reserves. So basically, he's covering both cases. He's covering A and B here, that you've got a positive target rate, but you're paying interest, and you've got a whole bunch of reserves supplied. And B is you've got a target rate of zero when you've got excess reserve supplied. Okay, so let's look at what these would look like in a Fed funds market. So this is basically the case where the central bank supplies a whole bunch of reserves. That's RBQE there on the horizontal axis all the way to the right. But then they pay interest on reserves at some positive rate instead of floor. And that's the one that's supposed to stop QE in its tracks. On the right hand side, on the other side, the northeast, we have the other one where the central bank doesn't pay interest and just does a whole bunch of QE and allows the rate to go to zero. The unfortunate thing for the sort of the monetarist view here is that those are the only two possibilities. Okay, I mean, if you think about the non-Fed funds market, because when you start to get into finance, everybody sort of, their heads explode. So just think about any market. Okay? You've got a demand curve and a supply curve. Now you shift the supply curve way to the right, way beyond the demand curve. What just happened? The price fell to zero, right? Unless you put in a price floor, then the price doesn't go to zero, it goes down to the price floor, right? That's sort of it, right? But notice that these are two cases that QE doesn't create inflation. But those are the two cases, those are the only two cases that you can have with QE. So QE can't cause inflation from their own view. Okay, so whether monetarism, some unpleasant arithmetic. Some people might know what I'm referring to there. So the operational reality, the Fed's direct target is an interest rate, plus banks are not reserve constrained. Fed funds market 101, banking 101. Is basically central bank leveraging is about asset prices, not the size of the leveraged banks. Can create as many loans with $2.8 trillion in reserve balances as they could, $15 billion or $10 billion, or as in Canada with zero. So it's about asset prices in that case. The other one would be the internal inconsistencies that we just looked at in the previous slide. The target rate equals interest on reserves, stop QE in its tracks. And the interbank rate at lower bound stops QE in its tracks. And unfortunately, those are the only operational possible ways to carry out central bank leveraging. Okay. So some concluding remarks. First off, is there a quantity effect from quantitative easing or from deleveraging, reversing quantitative easing? Meh. I don't know how to pronounce that as best I can do. Are there asset price effects? Yep. Paul was talking about this morning. The more important thing, though, is that recognizing central bank operations are about those asset price effects when we're talking about quantitative easing and so forth, or even when we're not, it's about where they set the interest rate target. It's not about the quantity. Unfortunately, that isn't in any of the textbooks. textbooks that we're teaching. It's not in the discourse. All we hear about is all this money the Fed's putting in the economy that's sloshing around, et cetera, et cetera. This has huge implications for a number of things that I don't have time to get into, but for instance, fiscal sustainability. If the government prints money to pay off the national debt or pay it to do its debt service, well, if it prints money, it's effectively doing one of those two. So those are the only two scenarios that can happen. So apparently printing money isn't inflationary either. Right? Okay, so I'm going to stop there. If hopefully I've made your heads explode.